You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Gillian McAllister.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you've never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. We look at all of this and more from a long-term strategic view, how to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Jillian McAllister on the show with me today. She has a phenomenal new book called The Good Sister, and you guys are really going to love this book. It has cost me some sleep at night, so thank you for that, Jillian. Welcome to the show.
Oh, you're most welcome. That's exactly what authors like to hear.
Of course it is. Jillian, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think I was probably about 10, and my father is quite an early adopter of technology, and he got me a computer that had Microsoft Word on it, and I just remember opening it and starting a novel, and there was no real thought process behind it. I've always read, and I've always wanted to be a writer without even kind of having a moment where I realized it. So I began my first novel then, age 10.
Wow. Do you remember what the novel was about?
I actually found the manuscript in his loft about 6 weeks ago. So it's called Where Magic is Possible, and it was like a high fantasy middle grade novel, I would say.
I love that. Were you a big reader as a kid?
Huge. Yeah, we had a library that called the bus library that was like a mobile library. I don't know if you have that
right.
State.
Sure.
And so it would come to a stop near our house, and I'd go up every Tuesday, I think it was, and get the maximum number of books out, which I think was 10, and read them all that week and take them back the following Tuesday. So yeah, I was a huge reader.
I love that. What kinds of books and stories really connected with you?
Well, I mean, it depends on the age. I grew, like most people of my generation, on Sweet Valley High, The Babysitter's Club, Point Horror. And then it was really probably I was about 17, 18, when I discovered sort of women's fiction. So Emily Giffen and Marianne Keyes, that sort of thing. And I started from there, really.
What was your introduction to mysteries and thrillers? Do you remember if there was a book or an author that told a story in a way that just really flipped that switch for you?
Yeah. So I think Gone Girl was quite perennial for many sort of female authors, sort of domestic thrillers, because it did something different and it had that giant, really incredible twist.
Right. Several
yeah.
of them.
several. There was a book over here, I don't know how well it did in the States, called Apple Tree Yard, which combined courtroom scenes with an exploration of a relationship, and that was really quite formative for me. And also Lisa Jewell in general has gone in a really interesting direction, I think, sort of from women's fiction to thrillers, and I just love everything she writes.
Yes, she's been on the show before. She is phenomenal.
Oh, I'm in good company.
Yes, absolutely. You practice law, don't you?
I did.
Yeah.
I am now a full-time writer, but yes, I was a lawyer until
nice.
November last year.
What was the thing that drew you to the law? What made you want to be an attorney or to study in that field?
I think it was quite a logical profession and quite endlessly interesting, really, and so varied. You could, you know, buy and sell buildings as a lawyer, but you could also, you know, administer divorces or defend criminals or be a judge. And it just, each aspect of it seems to me to be at the coalface of sort of what is to be human. You know, you could deal with immigration or, you know, administering wills and probate. Like, it's so varied, and I just think it's a very interesting career.
It's an interesting career for someone that wants to be a writer as well. There's lots of practice there for a writer that may not be creative writing in the typical sense, but I know a lot of writers that were lawyers and went through that, and they talk about that the practice of always putting something together, always writing, was good for them. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, totally. There's a lot of crossover in the skills. It's like law is a very wordy profession. If you're drafting a contract, each word matters, and it's really good training for precision of language. And likewise, drafting a long agreement and then having to, you know, negotiate an aspect of it and then thread that through from the beginning is so like writing a novel. Also, I think being a lawyer, it really does teach you to graft, which I think is a really underrated skill, like the ability to sit there for 12 hours and really sort something out and do it all of yourself and take on the responsibility. And you do need that to finish a novel. It's such a big endeavor, and you're the CEO of the novel. Like you have no real help for the majority of it until it goes to your agent or editor. So they're very similar professions, I would say.
Oh, and that is so overlooked and underrated when it comes to writing advice. It doesn't matter how talented you are. If you can't sit in the chair and put your hands on the keyboard, it's just never going to get done.
No, exactly. And I think that's what so many aspiring writers struggle with, is finishing. And I certainly kind of dilly-dallied around for years, not really getting past 10,000, 20,000 words of a manuscript. And the ability to just stick with an idea, see it through to the end, and then edit afterwards, I think that's the difference between people that end up getting published and people that don't.
I agree with you. Your first, your debut novel, Everything But the Truth, how long did you work on that book, and where did the idea to pursue that come from?
So I actually wrote that in 8 months. It was the time it takes me to finish a novel varies really from about 8 to 10 or 11 months. And that was a quick one. The idea actually came from hearing about a little known piece of British law that enables a defendant to be not guilty or innocent. There's a third verdict available in really specific, rare situations. And then I thought, as a woman, if I met somebody who had that verdict to their name, a literal ambiguous verdict, what would I think? And the idea came from there.
I love that. As someone who was working as a lawyer at the time, was that the, I guess, when you decided to write a book and include these legal aspects to the novel, was that just a natural progression from where you were in life? Were you a big fan of legal thrillers? You know, some people want to write the exact opposite of what their day job is. Was that ever a struggle for you, or did it just come naturally?
Well, I mean, I was a property lawyer, so there wasn't too much sort of criminal justice. I think I was probably naturally exposed to those legally and morally ambiguous areas, and I think it was quite natural for me, because I couldn't explore them in my day job, but I would hear about them and discuss them with lawyers. I wanted to sort of explore them in fiction, but really they're the sort of bedrock, and my books are really about relationships, although there are sort of legal elements there. Really, I'm using those legalities and crimes to test marriages and sibling relationships and sort of put them under the microscope.
Right. So you had more knowledge than the average reader, even though you practiced law, but not that kind of law. You knew the way around that kind of story, but it was different enough from what you were doing every day that it you still could get some excitement about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, my other half is a lawyer as well, and a lot of our friends are, and I think I am just quite exposed to those areas, and if there's ever an interesting legal news story, I will discuss it with a lot of lawyers, and it always tends to spark some interest and something I want to explore in fiction.
Right. That first book was a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller. Did that take you by surprise that the book was so well received and that it found an audience so quickly?
It did, of course. It changed my life, that novel. And I think as an author, you do get indications of how something's going to do when you know where it's going to be stocked and so on. But I remember the moment I found out it was number 6 in the whole country. I was actually at work, and it was like an out-of-body experience. It was truly bizarre. To have your life change in a second is very rare. Also, I'll remember it forever.
That's so exciting. After that, how do you follow up that book? Was it difficult to find another idea? Did you have one? Were you nervous about following up a debut that's that successful?
Well, the way that it kind of works when you're under contract, which I'm sure you know, is that the second novel was actually written by the time the first went into the bestseller list. And sure, it was an idea that kind of came knocking in the middle of the night. It was a sliding doors novel about a woman who commits a crime accidentally on the way home from a night out, and then the narrative splits. And in one version, she confesses and goes to trial for attempted murder. And in the other, she covers it up and effectively goes on the run. And it was such a big idea, and I was so excited about it. So I never really felt that kind of pressure because I'd already had that big next idea. So I was quite lucky in that way.
Nice. You said that you love to explore relationships and how, all sorts of relationships, but how we interact with one another and the natural drama that comes from that. The new book is called The Good Sister. Where did the idea to tackle the sibling relationship come from?
I have a sister myself, so there's just the two of us, so similar dynamic to in The Good Sister. And I'd kind of explored relationships in my first two novels, and I suddenly thought there are a lot of non-romantic relationships that are just as intimate. And so it was kind of a natural progression, really, for me to then decide to use a crime to put a strain on a sibling relationship and see kind of how that what bubbled to the surface when in doing so.
Nice. So when you decide to, let me ask you this. When you're starting a new book, what comes to you first? Is it an idea about a particular relationship and maybe some strain that you want to put on that relationship? Is it a plot point? Is it a character? How does it usually begin for you?
So for me, it's always the hook. So that sort of one-line elevator pitch. So with The Good Sister, it will be, what do you do if your sister is babysitting your child and something happens, the unthinkable happens? So it's kind of a moral dilemma, I suppose. And then I sort of go from there and I think, well, that's interesting, but what would the book kind of be about and what direction would I go? And for that one in particular, once somebody is accused of murder, it was obvious to me that it would be a courtroom drama.
Sure. When you start looking at the family dynamics and you've got two sisters, Martha and Becky, how do you decide about, characteristics of them and how one sister is kind of the steadying force for the other? And, how do you start building those characters to put them in the situations that you're going to bring them to?
Well, I thought with Becky, it would be most interesting if it was the volatile, younger, slightly more immature sister who was accused of the crime, because I think there would be natural prejudices in the family where, all families have somebody who's in their place. And I sort of thought, what if everybody knew she had a bit of a temper on her, but what if she's accused of the worst possible crime? And then I sort of thought I needed a counterpoint to that. And I think that dynamic of the calm, older, sort of in charge sister and the younger, more volatile sister is so common. And I think so many women can relate to that.
Sure, sure. Well, and not just women. I have a sister as well, and it's just the two of us. And, that sibling dynamic works across the board. I know there's a very particular relationship between sisters, but those ties and those strains really work across the whole spectrum.
Yeah, sure. And I think that sort of steadying force versus more dynamic person is often in romantic relationships as well. It's sort of an opposite attracts thing. So I hope it's sort of a universal concern.
Yeah. Your books have found an audience here in the States, and even though they're written in and about the UK and the very specific ways that the court system works there. Do you find that that the story and the plot translates across the pond, if you will?
I think so. I think everybody can relate to scenes in a courtroom. There's enough common ground there. You know, we both have juries. We both have innocent until proven guilty. And I think really the book is about the bond between the two sisters and the notions of who can you trust to look after your child and who is to blame when something goes wrong, and what is the price of forgiveness. I think they're sort of universal themes.
As you have practiced law and been around the legal system, have you ever come across a case that's like The Good Sister?
No, I haven't. I think it would be quite high profile if it happened, which is why I included little snippets of the media on the courthouse steps in The Good Sister. For me, it was really thinking about what happens if you put somebody in charge of your child and something happens. And then for me, I thought the most interesting scenario there is if the person in charge of your child is somebody that you already know. So there's sort of multiple family dynamics going on.
Right. When dealing with homicide, how does that differ, the legal process, in the UK, to the US? Does that translate? Are those things handled in the same way?
I think they are quite similar. I think the slight differences between the definition of, homicide and murder, respectively in each country. And likewise, I think the UK has two types of manslaughter, but they're definitely similar enough. You know, murder is sort of intent to cause, over here it's intent to cause grievous harm or death. And I think that's quite similar in the US. I think the sentences differ quite a lot. But I think, yeah, the charge would be very, very similar.
Gotcha. The other aspect to the relationships in this book, we're dealing with marriages and the fallout of grief and things like that. What were you drawing on when writing those relationships?
Well, I think I'm naturally quite interested in long marriages because so many fictional novels are about meeting somebody, but I was interested in what happens after that. In particular, what happens when the worst happens to Martha and her husband Scott, and how does their marriage fare under that pressure? And is the blame equally apportioned by society and themselves for leaving their young baby in the care of somebody else? And likewise, Becky's relationship with her, she's estranged from her husband, but they still really like each other. And I was quite interested there in, you know, what do you do if the person you know best is accused of a crime? Do you believe the police or do you believe your ex-wife? And I thought that was quite an interesting, complicated dynamic. And that's what I'm really interested in, is using the crimes as a device to kind of explore those relationships.
Well, I think we've all heard stories of people that have had a tragedy in their family and the family doesn't survive it. Marriages break down and things like that. In writing this, what do you think you learned about those relationships and how that maybe it is possible to weather a storm like that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You hear those statistics about sort of parents of missing children and grieving parents and how the divorce rate is so much higher. And I think what I try and conclude in The Good Sister is that you have to kind of weather it together and you have to learn to forgive each other for what role, whether that's big or small, that you might have played in the tragedy. And you also have to permit each other to change, because that will change you forever.
Sure. From the beginning, well, first off, do you know the ending of the book when you begin? I know you said that you like to kind of know that hook and know that elevator pitch when you're beginning, but do you know the full outcome for these characters from the beginning?
I did with this book, and I generally do tend to, but for this one in particular, because there is a surprise ending, I didn't want it to come out of left field. I think you have to kind of lay the groundwork for the reader, otherwise they feel a bit cheated. So for this one, I knew from page one what had happened.
Are you a plotter or are you a discovery writer? Do you work out all of the twists and turns ahead of time and then write toward those, or are you kind of figuring them out as you go?
I'm definitely a plotter. I don't know how people write novels without plotting. I just think I'd paint myself into a complete plot hole. But I do, so I do a first draft, kind of like a very quick first draft, usually sort of 9 to 10 weeks. And then I look at my plot plan and I sort of storyboard the novel, and then I decide what changes to make. And I often do then do a really, really big structural edit. So even though I plot, I do tend to rewrite as well. I'm sort of the worst combination of both, almost. But then I sort of replot again and then rewrite again. And then I kind of get it right that time, usually. I tend to do like 3 or 4 drafts before I deliver to publishers.
Yeah. One of the interesting dynamics in this book is the way that mothers are portrayed and how they are seen by society. Do you feel like mothers take a differently weighted blame when things happen than fathers do? And do you think that that's fair?
I think they do. And I think women in the public eye are beginning to explore this. I've seen a couple of celebrities kind of speak out when they're asked, you know, how do you balance motherhood with your career? They will point out that male actors or sports people or whoever are not asked that question. So I think society does finger point if something happens and it's the mother who's away. And I think mothers who choose to sort of go back to full-time work sooner than others are more harshly judged by society, and men aren't. But I think also women sort of internalize that judgment too, and there's a lot of self-blame, and it would be so great to see that sort of being, you know, start to talk about it and dismantle it and talk about how it sort of should be equal.
I think so too. It really should. And I don't know, is it just the nurturing nature of women that cause us to think of them as the nurturing force, therefore the protecting force? It's really a bizarre thing when you see how people are treated differently. Was that something that was really important to you to uncover and to really dig into in this book?
Yeah, it was. And it's hard to know whether it's innate or whether it's a societal pressure to put on women to be nurturing, and whether, you know, with the right conditions, that the natural nurturing within men could also be drawn out. It was definitely a sort of inequality that I have noticed amongst my friends and family members who have children. I've noticed that sort of slight inequality, and I really like to explore those kind of grey areas in fiction.
I like that. The sibling rivalry that we talked about, we don't really think about it so much, but a lot of these things that we go through as children, we carry through life. That's a really interesting theme in the book, is how this relationship continues into adulthood, and the things they carry with them, even when you don't live with that person anymore. There are things that are kind of set early on in our lives that we extend into adulthood. What was it like writing about that, and how do you think we could use a story like this to maybe work on our own sibling relationships?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, Becky has a place within her family as the sort of volatile younger sibling who, she's not really had a career. She regards herself, she has quite low self-esteem, and I think the family dynamics definitely play into that, and she puts herself there and they put her there too. And I suppose part of the lesson in The Good Sister is looking at why people have preconceptions within a family and how families really ought to permit change. And I think we all have that when you go home for Christmas, and, you know, if like I was always late as a teenager, and if I'm even 1 minute late now, there's eye rolling. It's like, Gillian's always late. But I think it's interesting because we should permit that change, because you're not the same person at 35 as you were at 15. And I think The Good Sister really tries to explore that. And when you have slightly like low self-esteem from childhood, or you've been put in a particular box, that really looms large when you're accused of a crime, because your sort of your personal history is paraded on the witness stand anyway.
Absolutely. The theme of memory is big in the book. Is memory something that we should trust implicitly? And you kind of explore that in the book. Or is, you know, do we have a tendency to change the way that we remember things? And how does that theme play into the story?
Well, I remember reading about something called confirmation bias, which is when something bad has happened, if you're asked about the events leading up to it, you will exaggerate. So it particularly was about people who are diagnosed with an illness that's related to mobile phone use. They were saying, how much were you on your mobile phone? Because they're trying to establish whether there's a link or not. And the people with the illness would say, I was on it absolutely loads. And that's because a bad thing has happened to them. And I was interested in that in the good sister, which is, you know, if your neighbor or your friend or somebody you know from the school gate is accused of a crime, suddenly everything they've ever done, every sort of raised voice and every toot of the horn in the car suddenly looms large, and you think, well, maybe they've got a temper problem, or, you know, maybe they're not a good person. And that's kind of what I wanted to explore, is that the justice system really sort of cracks you open, whether or not you're guilty.
Right. Well, the new book, The Good Sister, is out everywhere now. Jillian, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into your back catalog and follow along with everything coming up for you, is there a place that they can connect with you online?
Yes. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Jillian M. Author. And if you search Facebook for Jillian McAllister Author, you'll find me there.
Excellent. We're going to put a link to that in the show notes and a link to the new book, The Good Sister. Jillian, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today, and congratulations on the new book launch.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Seven men ran the farce, the seven witch hunters, the court of Oyer and Terminer. They tortured and lied and mutilated and murdered. They knew those women up in Salem Village were no witches. Their true target was the coven hidden in their own midst here in Salem Town. They meant to hang the innocent until the sisters surrendered. Did they surrender? Said Jason. No. Was that the wrong decision? To let innocent women die and save themselves? What do you think? Should the coven have fought openly? Created more hysteria by swooping in on broomsticks and casting spells over Salem? Should they have killed the judges? There are no right decisions. That is the horror of a witch hunt. Everything you do condemns you. Question the judge, thou art a defiant witch. Question his laws, you question the king, and thou art a treasonous witch. Question his superstitions, you question scripture, and thou art a blasphemous witch. Pity the condemned, you pity witches, and thy Christian mercy proves thy collusion with Satan. Witch hunters are not just bad lawyers practicing bad law. They are men who place the ends before the means. They choose their victim, a man, a woman, an entire race, and mark them for extinction. All evidence is damning evidence. All associations are damning associations. All infractions, and who among us is without sin, are unforgivable infractions. Their own failings and abuses of power are shrugged away as mere vigor in pursuit of the public good. A witch hunter will have you, by whatever means necessary. If he cannot find evidence, he will create evidence. He will entrap you and question you and distort what you say. He will walk you through the night until your feet bleed, strip you and stripe you, dress you in your own filth until you forget you are human. He will torture your friends until they betray you. And if anyone dares to weep at your hanging, he will drag them to Gallows Hill in the back of the next ox cart. Any man can be a witch hunter. All it takes is hatred and arrogance and the preening self-regard that proclaims, "My deeds are always good because they are my deeds." The seven judges of the Salem court were such men. But one witch stood up to them. She stood up to centuries of unchallenged, murderous dogma and pronounced the magic word, no. They burned her for it.